Hello, welcome to Mail Call, a podcast of newsletters and stories from the Great War. And happy Easter! Now, Easter season 2016 doesn't quite line up with Easter season 1916. So to help us get into the joyful mood of the season, let's go back to 1916 with an excerpt from the Chicago Ledger called Easter Time.
Easter Time. While we look forward from Easter, we may also look back at the festival itself as it has come to us from a time so far distant that nobody can put down a date and say, here Easter began. Indeed, this day is a great mixture of pagan, Jewish, and Christian ideas, though it stands out to us as a church festival to commemorate the resurrection of Christ. Mythology tells us about Ostara, the goddess of spring. The Jewish race looks back to a deliverance that has been commemorated by the Passover feast for centuries, and the records of the early Christian church tell us how the date for Easter was regulated by a council and how other festivals were reckoned from it. This is the time when life shows itself in the seed. Take seeds that are covered by a hard shell with soft fruit all around it. Birds eat the fruit, but they cannot open the shells, and so they drop them, carrying them perhaps some distance from the place where the fruit was discovered. That is the reason we find cherries, grapes, and cedar saplings scattered through the woods. The cedar tree has fruit that birds like. Then there are the hard nuts of our nut-bearing trees, every one containing a seed. Birds do not carry these about. No, but squirrels do. They bury them and do not find them again sometimes. Then the forgotten nut freezes and remains frozen all winter. But in the spring it thaws and bursts open, and the warmth and moisture of the soil bring the germ in the kernel to life, and we have a tree in course of time. But we don't put seeds with thin coats, like peas, beans, etc., in the ground till we are ready to have them germinate and grow. Freezing would destroy them, so we keep them safely through the winter, knowing all the while that the seed germ is inside, and that it will do just what we expect of it in the proper time. Easter time. The rising time.
Unfortunately, the Easter season we're going back to wasn't entirely joyous. In 1916, Irish nationalist men and women rose up against England to fight for Ireland's independence. England's centuries-old rule of Ireland had resulted in numerous Irish revolutions over the years. The Irish Rising of Easter Week 1916, although unsuccessful, initiated the final steps towards Irish independence. We bring you now the proclamation of the Irish Republic.
Irish men and Irish women, in the name of God and of the dead generations from which she receives her old tradition of nationhood, Ireland, through us, summons her children to her flag and strikes for her freedom. Having organized and trained her manhood through her secret revolutionary organization, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and through her open military organizations, the Irish Volunteers and the Irish Citizens' Army, having patiently perfected her discipline, having resolutely waited for the right moment to reveal itself, she now seizes that moment, and supported by her exiled children in America and by gallant allies in Europe, but relying in the first on her own strength, she strikes in full confidence of victory. We declare the right of the people of Ireland to the ownership of Ireland and to the unfettered control of Irish destinies to be sovereign and indefensible. The long usurpation of that right by a foreign people and government has not extinguished that right, nor can it ever be extinguished except by the destruction of the Irish people. In every generation, the Irish people have asserted their right to national freedom and sovereignty. 6 times during the past 300 years they have asserted it in arms, standing on that fundamental right, and again asserting it in arms, in the face of the world, we hereby proclaim the Irish Republic as a sovereign, independent state, and we pledge our lives and the lives of our comrades in arms to the cause of its freedom, of its welfare, and of its exaltation among the nations. The Irish Republic is entitled to, and hereby claims, the allegiance of every Irish man and Irish woman. The Republic guarantees religious and civil liberties, equal rights and equal opportunities for all of its citizens, and declares its resolve to pursue the happiness and prosperity of the whole nation and of all its parts, cherishing all the children of the nation equally, and oblivious of the differences carefully fostered by an alien government which have divided a minority in the past. until our arms have brought the opportune moment for the establishment of a permanent national government, representative of the whole people of Ireland, and elected by the suffrages of all of her men and women, the provisional government hereby constituted will administer the civil and military affairs of the Republic in trust for the people. We place the cause of the Irish Republic under the protection of the Most High God, whose blessing we invoke upon our arms, and we pray that no one who serves that cause will dishonor it by cowardice, inhumanity, or rapine. In this supreme hour, the Irish nation must, by its valor and discipline, and by the readiness of her children to sacrifice themselves for the common good, prove itself worthy of the august destiny to which it is called. Signed, on behalf of the Provisional Government. Thomas Clark, Sean McDermott, Thomas McDonough, P.H. Pierce, Eamon Cant, James Connolly, Joseph Plunkett.
Since the main communication lines from Dublin had been cut by the rebels, news of the uprising was scarce and speculative and, unless the paper or location had a specific interest in Irish affairs, came filtered through London. Take, for example, this article from the Washington Times, published April 25th, 1916, in the Home Edition. Rebels in Dublin seize part of city.
Rebels in Dublin seize part of city. 12 killed. Sea fight off England. Dublin post office seized. Battle in streets. House of Commons informed of suspected revolution throughout Ireland. Situation under control. London, April 25th. Irish rebels are in possession of 4 or 5 parts of the city of Dublin after 24 hours of most serious rioting. Augustine Birrell, Chief Secretary for Ireland, announced in the House of Commons this afternoon. Telegraphic communication with Dublin has been cut off, indicating that the principal portion of the city is held by the rebels. Rioting broke out afresh after soldiers under Curragh put down the first rebellion. Birrell first announced to Commons that the riots had been quelled and that the soldiers recaptured the Dublin post office, which was taken by the rebels in the first outburst yesterday. 12 persons were killed in the first fight, but because of the interruption of telegraphic communication, the government has no estimate on the total number of casualties. The outburst of rioting, it is considered certain, was part of a well-organized German attempt to stir up a great revolution in Ireland. The attempt of Sir Roger Casement and a strong force of German sailors to land on the Irish coast undoubtedly was part of the scheme. It is believed here that the Germans, using Sir Roger Casement as a tool, carefully planned in advance a revolution, counting on Sir Roger's dramatic appearance at the head of a German force to sweep the country. Birrell announced that arrests have been made, but said he was unable at this time to give any names. The Dublin General Post Office, which was seized by the rioters in the first attack, is an imposing stone structure situated on Sackville Street, a wide Dublin boulevard. It is admirably built to serve as a fortress if properly manned by guns.
Our next two stories come from the Spanish-language newspaper La Vanguardia, published in Barcelona. These accounts came through correspondents in London and show how the rising was depicted in foreign media.
De la insurrección de Dublín. Londres. La opinión pública británica ha visto con absoluta serenidad el movimiento revolucionario de Dublín, si bien lamentando profundamente que tales hechos se hayan producido, tanto más cuanto el ministro Mr. Burrell había declarado por 2 veces en la Cámara de Comunes ser dueño de la situación. No hay que olvidar, sin embargo, que la guarnición irlandesa es suficiente para ahogar todo alzamiento, aunque este no fuese aislado. La noticia de este alzamiento causará el más profundo dolor a la inmensa mayoría de nacionalistas, cuya lealtad está fuera de duda, y que han enviado al frente tantos millares de adeptos suyos. Es absolutamente cierto que la mayoría de irlandeses reprueban este hecho, y que los exaltados no tienen el menor apoyo en la casi totalidad de la masa de sus conciudadanos.
Of the insurrection in Dublin, London. British public opinion has seen with absolute serenity the revolutionary movement in Dublin, while deeply regretting that such events have occurred, especially as the minister Mr. Burrell had declared twice in the House of Commons that he was in control of the situation. One must not forget, however, that the Irish garrison is sufficient to drown all rebellion, although it was not isolated. The news of this uprising will cause the deepest sorrow to the vast majority of nationalists, whose loyalty is beyond doubt and who have sent thousands of their best men to the front. It is absolutely true that the majority of the Irish disapprove of the uprising, and that the extremists do not have the least support among most of their fellow citizens.
La ley marcial en Dublín, Londres. En la Cámara de los Comunes, Mr. Asquith ha dado cuenta de que han llegado a Dublín tropas procedentes de Bedford y de Inglaterra. Liberty Hall y Stephen's Green han sido ya ocupados por los soldados. En la ciudad y condado de Dublín se ha proclamado la ley marcial, habiéndose tomado enérgicas medidas para sofocar el movimiento y detener a los culpables. En el país reina tranquilidad. El gobierno toma las medidas necesarias para hacer saber a los neutrales la significación del último ejemplo de la propaganda alemana. Martial law in Dublin, London. In the House of Commons, Mr. Asquith related that troops have arrived in Dublin from Belfort and England. Liberty Hall and Stephen's Green have already been occupied by the soldiers. Martial law has been proclaimed in the city and county of Dublin, with strong measures taken to stifle the movement and arrest the culprits. In the country, tranquility reigns. The government has taken the necessary steps to make known to neutral parties the significance of the latest example of German propaganda.
Many accounts of the Easter Rising were recorded and published in the months and years following the event. The following excerpts depict just a few of the on-the-ground reports from those who participated in the rebellion. Linda Kearns was a nurse, tending to the fallen of both sides of the combat, until the British forced her to stop. She recalls the week's events in her diary, which was later published by her friend Annie M.P. Smithson, under the title, In Times of Peril.
These leaves from my diary of the last few years go back to our never-forgotten Easter week, 1916. For on the Wednesday of that week, I started a Red Cross hospital in an empty house in North Great George's Street. We collected bedding and stores of all kinds from the houses around, every one being most generous, and one friend supplying the dressing. I had six girls with me to help and two boys as stretcher bearers, and at once we were quite busy and got in a number of wounded, several women, some Republican soldiers, and a British Tommy who had a finger shot off and thought he was in a British emergency hospital and had no idea that he was in the hands of the enemy. On the Thursday morning, an officer of the British Army called and ordered me to make the hospital strictly military, meaning for British soldiers only, or to close it up. I chose the latter and closed the hospital, although with very real regret, sending the patients to the Mater and Temple Street hospitals. For the rest of that memorable week, I did dispatch work and helped in the streets when I could get the chance. I was in Moore Street on the afternoon when the O'Reilly was killed. One of the stretcher bearers was with me, and we saw him laying in the path and went over to him and found that he was dead. But life must have only just left him, for he was quite warm. I've heard many stories since of his death, but do not think any of them can be true. We concluded that death must have been instantaneous, for he did not appear to have moved after he had fallen. How calm and peaceful he looked there, clad in the uniform of the Republic for which he died, and with his dead face turned up to that heaven where his patriot soul had surely gone. Well, Easter week, and its aftermath of blood and tears passed, and no doubt England, in her stupidity, believed that she had quenched the sparks of rebellion beyond rekindling. All the world knows now that the contrary was the result, and that from the smoldering embers of that week flared up to the mighty blaze that was to light our land from end to end.
Margaret Skinninger recorded her experience in Doing My Bit for Ireland. For much of the week, she divided her time between being a dispatch driver and using her shooting skills as a sniper for the rebels at St. Stephen's Green and the College of Surgeons. In the following story, she tells us how the Countess, Constance Markievicz, single-handedly took over the College of Surgeons.
As we went back to the Green, Madam told me of the attempt made that morning by herself, Sean Connolly, and 10 others to enter Dublin Castle and plant the flag of the Irish Republic on the roof of that stronghold of British power in Ireland. There always is a considerable military force housed in the castle, but so completely were they taken by surprise that for a few moments it seemed as if the small group would succeed in entering. It was only when their leader, Sean Connolly, was shot dead that the attempt was abandoned. Immediately after this gallant attempt, which might have succeeded had it taken place on Sunday with the number of men originally intended, Madam returned to St. Stephen's Green, and alone and single-handed took possession of the College of Surgeons. This is a big, square granite building on the west side of the green. It was, as we later discovered, impregnable. For all impression they made, the machine-gun bullets with which the British soldiers peppered it for 5 days might have been dried peas. The Countess, fortunately, had met with no resistance. She walked up the steps, rang the bell, and, when no one answered, fired into the lock and entered.
Here at Mail Call, we don't want to give the impression that every story from the Rising was romantic or tragic. We bring you now a humorous tale from Brian O'Higgins from the book Laughter Lighted Memories.
As everybody is aware, a great deal of looting was carried on in Easter week, as is carried on in all big cities in times of commotion or upheaval, and the task of stopping it was a bigger one than the small forces at the disposal of the Republic could accomplish. A certain zealous priest, having heard of the wholesale thieving at O'Connell Street, Earl Street, and Henry Street, hurried down to endeavor to stop it. Somewhere about Parnell Square he met a boy who was bent under the weight of some 20 pairs of boots. The good priest thought he might as well start his work of prevention there and then. "Where did you get those boots, boy?" he demanded in stern tones. The lad looked over his shoulder and hurried on. "In Earl Street, father," he said eagerly, "but you'll have to hurry up, or they'll all be gone."
We're going to take a quick commercial break. When we return, we're going to turn to the United States and see how the Gaelic Americans on the U.S. side reacted to the rebellion.
Irish men and women, our brothers in the old land, have risen as the American patriots rose and against the same foe. The long-expected opportunity has arrived, and they have determined to seize it. Let us rally to their support. A mass meeting will be held at the Conan Theater, Broadway and 43rd Street, New York City, on Sunday, April 30th, 1916, at 8 p.m. Bring your friends. No admission fee. No reserved seats.
What the Irish have done for America. The story of the Irish in America has been variously told. Facts have been twisted to suit prejudice, and the truth has been either ignorantly or maliciously ignored by historians of the past. In these days, when the term hyphenated American is applied to all Americans who are not pro-British, men of Irish blood should be fortified with the facts showing the importance of the part played by the race in the establishment of American liberties and industrial prosperity, and be able to correct false views. They should be able to inform their children and their friends just what it meant to this country that the Irish came here in such large numbers. The Irish Contribution to America's Independence by Thomas Hobbes McGinnis, Jr. is a book of vast importance from a historical point of view, and especially to every person in America of Irish blood. It refutes published misstatements and contains such valuable and interesting information about the Irish race as compared with the Anglo-Saxon. It is a book every American of Irish blood should possess, a book that everyone can understand, and one that is extremely interesting to every man and woman who is interested in promoting the cause of the Irish race in America. Copies may be obtained at this office or be mailed to any address, postpaid, on receipt of $1. The Gaelic American, 165 William Street, New York City.
Welcome back. In the United States, the Irish American population was very interested in the fight for Irish independence. The Gaelic American, a weekly newspaper published in New York, noted the inconsistency and bias of the mainstream news media regarding news from Ireland. Here now an excerpt from the edition published April 29, 1916.
Ireland, in arms, fighting for freedom. Ireland is fighting gallantly for her independence. That is the fact that stands out clearly in the garbled and censored cable dispatches which have been coming by a roundabout route from London since Monday evening last. And not one line would have come until it suited England to let the news filter out, falsified, had not Irish ingenuity devised the means of getting a cipher cablegram through to New York late last Saturday night, in spite of the British censor. By a roundabout route, it reached its destination at noon on Sunday, and means were taken to compel the New York dailies to make an effort to get the news. It has been coming in driblets ever since, each succeeding dispatch proving conclusively that all previous ones were intended to hide the truth and minimize the extent of the revolt. The military situation in Ireland is becoming clear hour by hour. What was first stupidly described as an attempt to wreck an excursion train near Maryborough in Queens County, meaning a troop train, later in the same day became an attack on the Dublin post office in which 12 rioters and 5 soldiers were killed, and still on the same day was transformed into a formidable attempt to capture the Irish capital, resulting in a battle which up to Tuesday morning had raged for more than 24 hours. Between the lines of the censored cables, one could read that Dublin was in the hands of the rebels until strong reinforcements of the British troops arrived from camp at Curragh Kildare, 30 miles away, and the fight was resumed. Chief Secretary Burrell was quoted as admitting in the House of Commons that the rioters were in possession of 4 or 5 important points in Dublin, and one of the dispatches described these points as the principal parts of the city. As this is being written, the news is still coming piecemeal, with the admission that the revolt is of a more serious character, but with the usual smug English statement that the government has the situation well under control. As the Gaelic American goes to press on Wednesday, it will only be possible to give the news reaching New York evening papers up until that afternoon.
Because the Gaelic American was a weekly newspaper published on Saturdays, their publishing schedule meant that the previous article actually came out on the day the rising came to an end. The rebels surrendered unconditionally on April 29th. 3,500 people were court-martialed, arrested, or otherwise detained, more than twice the number who actually participated in the rising. And all 7 signatories of the proclamation were tried and executed for treason. A subsequent issue of the Gaelic American from May 13th describes some of the aftermath.
Military massacre in Dublin under the rule of an English court-martial. Within a few hours after the surrender of the revolutionary forces, 3 of the chiefs were shot by a firing squad, and the slaughter went on for a whole week until 12 men were added to the glorious roll of Irish martyrs. Patrick H. Pierce, Thomas J. Clark, Thomas McDonough, Joseph Plunkett, Michael O'Hanoran, Major John McBride, Edward Daly, William Pierce, Cornelius Colbert, Edmund Kent, Michael Mallon, and J.J. Houston, the names which will be cherished for all time by the Irish race. Many others, including several Protestants, get long terms of imprisonment, and thousands of captives are sent to England and Belfast. British government, in a panic, adds fuel to the flame of Irish revolution and hatred. The traitor Redmond approves the murder of the leaders, his political opponents, and then prates of the clemency for the rank and file. Irishmen the world over, aroused to bitter anger, will exact heavy retribution. 12 men taken in arms in Dublin, in the military uniform of the Irish Republic, and therefore having the right to be treated as prisoners of war, have been murdered by the English military authorities in Dublin, with the approval of the arch-traitor Redmond. A number of other men, several of whom are Protestants, and some of them Ulstermen, have been given long terms of imprisonment, and several thousands of men from all parts of the country have been taken as prisoners to England because the British government is afraid to keep them in Ireland. Several hundred other prisoners have been sent to Belfast because it is the only place in Ireland where the government can be sure of holding them. A reign of terror prevails all over Ireland, but even John Redmond admits that the people are not terrorized, but are growing angrier every hour.
Sean McDermott, one of the 7 signatories of the Proclamation of the Irish Republic, was executed on May 12, 1916. The following is his last letter from Kilmainham Jail to his friend John Daly of Limerick. The letter is dated May 11, 1916, and it was reprinted in the Clonlanoil Journal in October.
McDermott's last letter, Dublin, May 11th, 1916. My dear John, just a wee note to bid you goodbye. I expect in a few hours to join Tom and the other heroes in a better world. I have been sentenced to a soldier's death, to be shot tomorrow morning. I have nothing to say about this, only that I look on it as a part of the day's work. We die that the Irish nation may live. Our blood will rebaptize and reinvigorate the old land. Knowing this, it is superfluous to say how happy I feel. I know now what I have always felt, that the Irish nation can never die. Let present day place hunters condemn our action as they will, posterity will judge us aright from the effects of our action. I know I will meet you soon. Until then, goodbye. God guard and protect you and all in number 15. You have had a done trial, but I know quite well that Mrs. Dally and all the girls feel proud in spite of a little temporary and natural grief that her son and the girls, their brothers as well as Tom, are included in the list of honors. Kindly remember me, especially to Mrs. Clark, and tell her I am the same Sean that she always knew. God bless you all. As ever, sincerely yours, Sean McDermott.
Before we end this special episode of Mail Call, we'll check in with a few short updates from the Ardmore Chronicle. The following three short articles were published on April 29, 1916, all in the Ardmore Chronicle.
Real U.S. Dogs of War. Fanciers form club to start in training animals. New York. Organization of a movement to breed and train dogs for the use of the United States Army, the American Red Cross Society, or other military or relief organizations was announced here. For that purpose, dog fanciers have formed the Army and Police Dog Club of the United States. Dogs will also be trained for police work. It is proposed to maintain a registry of trained canines subject to a call from Army officers.
L3 delivered to government. Largest submersible, one of seven ready by July 1st. Boston. The submarine L3, one of the largest submersibles in the United States Navy, was formally delivered to the government by her builders, the Four River Shipbuilding Company, at the Charleston Navy Yard and immediately placed in commission. The seven vessels of this class, each with a cruising radius of 5,500 miles, will be in service by July 1st, the builder stated.
Says crisis kills hyphen. Bartolt declares German Americans will stick to U.S. St. Louis. Richard Bartolt, former congressman, apostle of peace, and, since the European War, protagonist of the German cause in America, declared that the present crisis dehyphenated German Americans. He was asked what the Germans in the United States would do in case of war between the countries. There is no excuse for such a question, he said. History has shown that the Germans always were the most loyal citizens of the United States in time of war. In this crisis, there are no German Americans. We are all Americans.
We'll end this episode of Mail Call with William Butler Yeats's poem, Easter, 1916, which he wrote in September of the same year.
I have met them at close of day, coming with vivid faces from counter or desk among gray 18th-century houses. I've passed with a nod of the head or polite, meaningless words, or have lingered a while and said polite, meaningless words, and thought before I had done of a mocking tale or a jibe to please a companion around the fire at the club, being certain that they and I but lived where motley is worn. All changed, changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. That woman's days were spent in ignorant goodwill, her nights in argument until her voice grew shrill. What voice more sweet than hers when young and beautiful she rode to harriers? This man had kept a school and rode our winged horse. This other, his helper and friend, was coming into his force. He might have won fame in the end, so sensitive his nature seemed, so daring and sweet his thought. This other man I had dreamed, a drunken, vainglorious lout. He had done most bitter wrong to some who are near my heart. Yet I numbered him in the song. He too has resigned his part in the casual comedy. He too has been changed in his turn, transformed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. Hearts with one purpose alone, through summer and winter seem enchanted to a stone to trouble the living stream. The horse that comes from the road, the rider, the birds that range from cloud to tumbling cloud, minute by minute change. A shadow of a cloud on the stream changes minute by minute. A horse hoof slides on the brim, and a horse splashes within it. Where long-leg moorhens dive and hens to moorcocks call, minute by minute they live, the stones in the midst of all. Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart. Oh, when may it suffice? That's heaven's part. Our part to murmur name upon name as mother names her child when sleep at last has come on limbs that had run wild. What is it but nightfall? No, no, not night but death. Was it needless death after all? For England may keep faith. For all that is done and said, we know their dream, enough to know they dreamed and are dead. And what if excess of love bewildered them till they died? I write it out in verse, MacDonagh and MacBride, and Connolly and Pierce, now and time to be, wherever green is worn, are changed, changed utterly, a terrible beauty is born.
That concludes Mail Call, a podcast of newsletters and stories for the Great War. Thank you for listening to our Easter Rising special. Historical documents for this episode were accessed through the digital collections of the Digital Library at Villanova University, the Internet Archive, and the Library of Congress. Our theme music this week is The Wearing of the Green, as performed by the Metropolitan Band with Otto Meslow. The Mail Call podcast is a project of Home Before the Leaves Fall, a Great War Centennial Exposition. This episode featured the voice talents of Laura Bang, Leah Clark, Sean Connolly, Kevin Esmond, Claudia Gonzalez-Rives, Elena Jimenez-Pizarro, Damian Katz, Patrick McAndrew, Jessica Otterbein, Alex Rosenfeld, David Uspel, and Caleb Van Osten. This episode was edited by our executive producer Laura Bang and myself, Chris Hallberg. For more information, please visit our website at wwionline.org.